No, that wasn't true. She wouldn't. He was Gifford's father. Lord Dudley? She addressed only him on this, since her mother had been silent on the matter so far. As queen, it's my duty to see to my predecessor's funeral arrangements, and I wish to pay my respects to him first, privately. He was silent as they turned into a more crowded hall. People glanced at her and whispered. A few bowed. "Very well," Dudley said. "I will make arrangements for you to visit him. I'm afraid it won't be today, though. There's too much to do." If they waited much longer, she'd be visiting a rotting corpse. According to The Glorious and Gruesome Stages of Death, a beginner's guide, bodies began deteriorating very quickly, bloating and stinking and decaying until all that was left was a horrifying echo of the people they had been before. Jane had seen her father and Catherine Parr shortly after they'd died, and that had been horrible enough. She didn't want to see Edward in the rotting stage. The thought made a shudder run deep through her. "Arrange it as soon as you are able," she said sharply, a terrible thought springing to her mind. Dudley didn't want her to see her cousin's body. Something was wrong here, outside of the obvious wrongness of Edward being dead and Jane being queen. Something was very wrong, and she intended to find out what it was. The rest of the day was a whirlwind of first day as queen moments, standing in front of the Privy Council as the members introduced themselves, sitting on the throne as some of the more prominent merchants of London came to visit her, signing documents about palace staff, various lords' holdings and marriage requests. The last bit made her feel a little guilty, but evidently the first several requests on the pile were for people who wanted the arrangement approved, so she decided to think of it as giving her blessing. Still, it was disconcerting to have that kind of power in her hands. Those were a string of more actions that Edward would never again take, signing his name, picking at a thread on the throne cushion, and hearing every council member talk about how great and terribly important they were. Maybe that wasn't something to be missed. There were also a handful of invitations to preside over state events, visit various nobles' country homes, and attend something called the Red Wedding. Jane checked the "will not attend" box without giving this last invitation a second thought, as if she wanted to go to any more weddings. None of it seemed very important, though. Nothing significant or helpful to the people. It was all busy work. She was given time to eat, but otherwise kept occupied. There was little opportunity to think about Edward or ask questions about Dudley's motives or do much of anything but wonder if she couldn't put in an order for a new throne. She felt like a child sitting in this one, her feet barely touching the floor. And, annoyingly, Lord Dudley insisted on accompanying her everywhere, like he was afraid that the moment she was out of his sight she'd be out the window and heading for the hills, which didn't sound like such a bad idea at this point. "There was much Edward wasn't able to do in his final days," he was saying to her now mournfully. Dusk was falling. They were both waiting for Gifford at an exit near the stables, with amber sunlight falling through the open door and casting long, dark shadows down the hallway. "Our late king was so very ill. One of his last acts was to name you as his successor. It was his only thought, his only goal in those hours, naming the one person he trusted above all others. Above even the Duke himself. He was trying to flatter her, certainly. Yes, well, I still wish to see his body," she said. "Perhaps tomorrow," Dudley agreed faintly. "I'd also like to travel to the palace at Greenwich as soon as we're able to see his room and his books. And what has happened to his dog, Petunia? I should like to see her as well. Can she be brought here?"
"Of course,"
Dudley said, but she could tell by the look on his face that he had no real intention of seeing to her requests. But why deny her? What was he hiding? She turned to gaze out at the sun, which was slowly falling below the horizon. She wished it would move faster. She'd feel better with Gifford here. "I also want all but one of the wardrobes moved out of my room," she said, as if that were the conversation they'd been having the entire time. "There's no need for every single one of them. Store them someplace else if you feel I need that many garments." Dudley's lips thinned with a frown. "Your room would be quite bare without them, Your Majesty." "We'll replace the wardrobes with something else, obviously."
"What else could a queen possibly want in her chambers?"
Lord Dudley managed to look genuinely flummoxed.
"A large mirror to make the room appear bigger? A golden stand to rest your crown upon each night?"
Jane wasn't even wearing the crown now. She had no idea where it was. Dudley continued,
"A loom? Paintings? A spinning wheel? A chair for knitting in?"
He clearly didn't know her at all. "Oh, my knitting skills are the foundations of textile legend," she said, resisting the urge to roll her eyes. Dudley brightened, as though relieved to have figured out something that would occupy so much of her time.
"A chair for knitting you shall have, then, and all the yarn and needles a beautiful queen could desire."
"Ha! Father, don't be daft." Gifford approached, a tall shadow against the twilight sky. "What my wife desires, and what you should have guessed had you paid attention, is bookcases, and books, of course, to fill them. Not more decorations or useless items. She wants books." Jane's heart jumped as Gifford paused next to her, the sleeve of his jacket brushing her elbow. He knew about bookcases. He'd called her his wife. A tiny thrill managed to burst through the grief and confusion she'd been swamped in all day.
"My husband is correct," she said, smiling. "Bookcases, books. There's nothing I like more."
"Except me."
Gifford winked at her, though. They both knew that wasn't true. Dudley clapped his hand down on Gifford's shoulder.
"Ah, son, I'm glad to see you return from your daily deviation from—"
"Yes." Gifford cleared his throat.
"Same as I do every evening."
Tension snapped between the men. Jane's skin prickled at the sudden memory of Gifford slipping away last night to go speak with his father. What had Gifford and Dudley talked about? Gifford had said nothing to her about Dudley since her coronation. He had been unusually quiet, actually, about everything. Uncharacteristically quiet. One might even say suspiciously quiet. Well, he'd been a horse all day, of course. He hadn't had time to confide everything. Jane sighed. She didn't trust Lord Dudley. But why? There had to be more to her misgivings than her dislike of the man and his nose.
"Come," Gifford offered his arm, and she took it. "Let's go into supper. I'm starving for something other than hay."
Dinner was insufferable. First, she had to dress in layers and layers of foolish finery, furs and silks and velvets, jewels on her fingers and neck and hair, and worst of all, a type of platform shoe that she was forced to wear so that her dresses, which hadn't yet been hemmed to her slight frame, wouldn't drag the floor. Then she and Gifford were paraded into the great hall, where 100 courtiers waited. At her arrival, they all stood until she took her place at the head of the table. Everyone was watching her, and she dearly would have liked to shrink or crawl under the table, neither action befitting of a queen. Gifford sat on her left, Lord Dudley on her right, throughout the various courses of the meal. Soups and soufflés, pies and pastries, and veal and venison. There was so much food, Jane thought she might explode. So much food, the people in the villages she and Gifford had visited could have lived on it for a week. The thought of so much extravagance and waste while there were Englishmen suffering and starving made her feel a bit sick. They were halfway through the meal, eating some kind of meat pie, when Lord Dudley turned to Jane. "Your Majesty," he said quietly, so that the other people at the table besides Gifford might not hear, "I thought we should discuss when to hold my son's coronation. Not tonight, as I'm sure you're exhausted, but tomorrow night would be appropriate, and then we'd have the day to prepare. I've already got his crown picked out." Jane stilled, her fork lifted halfway to her lips. "His crown?" "Yes, to make Gifford the king." "Gifford the king." Jane's hand trembled as she set her fork down. "The king." That was it, then. This whole mess made sense. The hasty wedding, the generosity of using the country house, the way he'd insisted she be crowned queen only moments after she learned of Edward's death, foregoing all of the traditional procedures. It was so obvious she felt stupid for not seeing it before. Through her, and through crowning Gifford king, John Dudley meant to rule England. "No!" The word burst out of her. She darted a glance at Gifford. Shock flickered across his face, and then was snuffed out as quickly as a candle. Dudley's nose turned red. "And why not?" She hardened her expression. Maybe she should have worn her crown today. "Your Majesty," he added. She lowered her voice to just above a whisper. "There are several reasons, none of which I am obligated to divulge to you, but I will give you the most obvious reason, which is that Gifford is a horse." Dudley's jaw practically dropped, which only encouraged Jane to go on. "Consider it," she said, leaning toward the Duke. "How can your son help me rule the kingdom when he's present only half the time, and during the half when most people are asleep?" Gifford signalled for the serving boy to bring him more wine. "Your Majesty, please reconsider," Lord Dudley pleaded. "Your position will be much stronger with your husband as king. The people will see it as a sign of strength." She took a deep breath. "They need signs of my strength, not my reliance on the men around me."
"But every queen needs a king," Dudley sputtered.
She shook her head. "If you feel he needs a title, I can make him a duke. Duke of Clarence, perhaps. How's that?" Gifford snorted, a noise that was remarkably horse-like, lifted his goblet and drank deeply.
"Your Majesty, I must implore you to change your mind."
Dudley paused and came at the subject in a new, calculatedly kind way.
"This is understandably a difficult time for you. Let's not be hasty with this decision."
"Indeed," she said coolly, "I would undoubtedly feel more at ease if I could visit my cousin's body. Perhaps after that we can discuss the Prince Consort." Lord Dudley rubbed his chin, nearly losing a finger to the dagger of his nose, and nodded.
"We should delay this discussion until a more suitable time presents itself."
"Yes," Jane agreed. "A more suitable time." She dared another look at her husband. Gifford's cheeks were flushed and his eyes were bright as he drained yet another goblet of wine. A servant rushed forward to refill.
"No more,"
Jane said, much too loudly. She reached across her husband's plate and laid a hand on the rim of his goblet just before the servant began to tip the pitcher of wine. "You've had enough." Chatter in the dining hall softened and then made a full stop. Everyone looked at Jane with her hand over Gifford's goblet and the servant standing there awkwardly, and Gifford sitting between them with his face slowly turning red. Belatedly, Jane realized what she had done. Under the stares of shock and amusement, Jane pulled away from Gifford and his still empty goblet and slowly stood up. Everyone else followed immediately. "I've had a long day," Jane announced. "I'd like to retire for the evening. Darling husband, do you wish to join me?" Maybe if they talked, he'd say all the things she wanted to hear, that he agreed with her, that he found the idea of being king silly and unnecessary, that this was all his father's idea, his father's scheming, not his. She turned to Gifford. The turn of his mouth said something like, "I don't know. What do you want me to do? I am, after all, yours to command." But he held out his arm for her to take. "Nothing would delight me more than to spend time in your magnificent company." They walked in tense silence. When they reached their chambers, she strode into her bedroom and threw off her outer robe like she couldn't bear its weight any longer, then started plucking the jewels from her throat and hair. Gifford lingered in the doorway. "Are you coming in?" she asked, pausing to hurl her platform shoes into the corner. "There's nowhere to sit, but feel free to pull up a wardrobe." He came in and let the door shut behind him. "What would you like to discuss with me, Your Majesty?" Gifford's tone held none of his typical friendliness. His brown eyes were cold, a muscle ticked in his jaw.
"You're angry," she observed.
Gifford raised an eyebrow.
"What right have I to be angry? I am merely your subject, Your Majesty."
Jane scowled.
"Don't be silly. You aren't merely my subject."
"Then what am I, Your Majesty?"
Jane clenched her fists and paced faster.
"You're my husband, my prince consort."
"Yes, Your Majesty, and your prince consort I shall remain."
He was being so childish.
"Stop saying Your Majesty!"
Jane tore a pillow off her bed and hurled it at him. He sidestepped it quickly. "I told you not to call me that!"
He blinked slowly, as though trying to give an impression of guilelessness.
"Then what should I call you, Your Majesty?"
"Use my name!"
"Yes, Your Majesty!"
He bowed and swirled his hand a few times in an overly dramatic display of courtesy.
"Anything you say, Your Majesty, and not to question Your Majesty, but shouldn't you be using the royal we? You are all of England now." He paused a beat. "Your Majesty."
"Why are you even angry about this?"
She hurled another pillow, which he again artfully dodged.
"You hate politics. You've been avoiding court for years."
She gave a bitter laugh.
"The idea's so ridiculous, it's almost sad. Can you imagine yourself prancing around the throne room, having carrots fed to you between petitions? What use could you possibly be as the king?"
"So you think I'm ridiculous? You think I'm useless?"
"I didn't say that."
She brandished another pillow.
"You didn't have to say it. Just because I don't spend all my time with a book attached to my nose doesn't mean I can't infer what you meant."
He still hadn't moved, aside from dodging pillows. His hands were behind his back, his chin was lifted, even his hair was perfect.
"Admit it. You're ashamed that I'm an Ethian."
"No!
But this is still a dangerous place for Ethians, and it's already causing talk that dinner is held after dark, just like our wedding, even in high summer." "Tell them I'm a vampire," he said. "That should give them something to talk about. Anyway, what about all those decrees we discussed? Making the kingdom safe for Ethians, protecting the innocent, helping the poor. What were you doing all day if not securing the safety of your people, Your Majesty?"
100 things you couldn't begin to understand since you spent your day galloping about the fields and eating apples. I didn't ask for any of this, you know. I haven't had a moment's peace since we came here. First, I'm told that my best friend is dead. And, oh, by the way, that means that I'm the queen now. Surprise! A position I'm not remotely prepared for, and I only agreed to accept because you encouraged me. Then, instead of being allowed to mourn for my cousin, I'm shuffled from place to place, signing insignificant documents and picking the colour of the new table linens and meeting people I hate, all the while wondering why your father clearly wants you on the throne so badly. "Why wouldn't she want me on the throne?" Gifford asked. "Well, you have to admit, this is awfully convenient for you. A quick marriage to somebody who's suddenly in line for the throne. After all, I know you didn't marry me for my hair." "I married you because I was given no choice," he said. "And of course you had no idea that your father was planning on making you the King of England." "Didn't you hear him, Gifford? He's already got your crown picked out." "What makes you afraid to share power?" he said hotly. "Why couldn't I be king?" So there it was. He wanted to be king. Perhaps that was what he'd wanted all along. The pillow dropped from her hand. She took a step back, the betrayal of it piercing her through. All her life she'd known that she was being used as a pawn in other people's political games, by her father, by Thomas Seymour, by her own mother, and now by Lord Dudley. But she hadn't wanted to imagine that she'd be used by Gifford. "Is that all I've been to you?" she asked, struggling to keep the tremor from her voice. "A means to an end?" He stared at her, hurt flashing in his eyes. "You don't trust me." "I don't trust anyone," she cried. "How can I, when it's clear that this is all a game?" "Jane, I saw you and your father speaking after the coronation. He put his hand on your shoulder like he was proud of you. What were you even talking about?" Gifford didn't answer. "See, you're doing exactly what he wants." Her face was hot, boiling. She'd never been so wounded and so angry in her life. "I am not!" Gifford scooped up a pillow from the floor and threw it at her, though his aim was wide and he missed by quite a bit. "You're even terrible at throwing!" she yelled. "I missed on purpose!" He marched to the door connecting her room and his. "Now, if you'll excuse me, Your Majesty, I've had enough accusations for one evening." "Fine. Go away. I don't want to see you." He hauled open the door on her side, finding another door on the other. It had no handle. He pushed at it, rattling the door in its frame a few times before he realized it wasn't going to let him through. "What makes you think you're qualified to be king when you can't even open a door?" With an indignant snort, he slammed her door shut again and marched out the front door. Slam! A few seconds later, slam! He'd gone into his room. "Well, good. I never want to see you again," she shouted through the adjoining door. "Just read your stupid books." "My books aren't stupid, you're stupid!" Jane threw a pillow at the door. An answering thump signalled another pillow, or maybe even a shoe. Jane sank to her bed, the fire draining out of her. She choked on a sob. She wouldn't cry, she wouldn't. She refused to cry about Gifford. But then she did. She was a 16-year-old girl, after all, and sometimes a 16-year-old girl needs to throw herself into a pillow and let the tears come as they may. 15. Gifford. G had never wanted to hit someone with a pillow so much before in his life. He couldn't believe how the evening had gone, nor could he believe how his wife really perceived his usefulness as a half-man incapable of ruling over his own wine goblet, let alone the country. Jane didn't want him to be king. It wasn't like he had ever yearned for the crown. Being royalty looked like too many people telling a person what to do, if you asked him. And yet, when one's wife wore the crown, one got to think maybe a follicular adornment like a crown wouldn't be so bad. It made sense. Otherwise, how would the introductions of the royal couple go? "Ladies and gentlemen, presenting Her Majesty, the Queen of England, escorted by this fellow." Really, he should blame his father. Dudley had been preparing him to become king, speaking of the coronation as if it were inevitable, saying things like, "We'll discuss that when you're king," and "When you're king, you really should have a changing room built closer to the stables." He'd never wanted the crown, but he hadn't thought his wife would deny it to him, and with such veracity. Granted, they had only been married for a little more than a week, so it shouldn't have been surprising that she didn't trust him. But how could she not trust him? G spent the early morning of day 5 of Queen Jane's rule cantering through the grassy lowlands to the north and east of the castle. He kept trying to think of all the reasons why it was good not to be a king. First, it would be hard to gallop with a crown. Second, if he were king, he would rarely be alone and would hardly be allowed to jaunt about the countryside on his own. He'd probably have an adviser on his back. How degrading. Third, he had to admit his lady was the more knowledgeable one. He was sure that somewhere along the way Jane had read a book with a title like How to Rule a Kingdom Even If You're 32nd in the Line of Succession and Chances Are You'll Never Actually Rule, Volume 1 of 3. And finally, being a king was exactly the kind of responsibility G liked to avoid. If he were king, people would expect great things of him. His every action would be judged and weighed against the monarchs of the past. And if he made mistakes, well, a king's mistakes had consequences. It was a lot of pressure. "Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown," G thought. Which was a pretty good line. He wished he had ink and paper and hands with opposable thumbs so he could write it down. G snuffed the horse's equivalent of a sigh. He'd never wanted to be king, and his lady presented some logical reasons for her decision, although at the time he would have appreciated the logical reasons being delivered in a less hostile way. Preferably with fewer pillows whooshing past his head. Still, the rejection burned. G slowed from a canter and leisurely trotted over toward a brook winding its way through the valley. He lowered his head and slurped water. It tasted cool on his tongue and helped calm his burning ego. What did a life as prince consort look like? He couldn't help picturing it as some sort of personal valet who attended the left side of the queen with astute devotion, and when the queen said, "I'm thirsty," he would reply by jumping to his feet and saying, "Your Majesty, if I have to search out the magical Carpesian waters of Romania myself, killing loads of bandits along the way, you shall have your water." G shook his mane and whinnied, the sound definitely coming across as a whine, even to his own ears. He realized that, in reality, he would not be a personal valet, and even if he were, there would most likely be a pitcher of water nearby. The sun shot across the sky much faster than he liked. He could almost see the streak marks. Sometimes he dreaded turning into a horse and leaving his humanity behind, but today he dreaded the setting sun and the fact that he would soon have to face his wife. He wanted to be supportive and caring, and he wanted to talk about how they were going to change the kingdom, and he didn't want to feel inferior and powerless, because he knew Jane, at least he thought he knew her, and he knew she would not make him feel inferior and powerless.
G had always thought of himself as a rather enlightened sort of fellow, especially compared to the other men of the day. When his brother Stan's wife had questioned Stan during a family dinner, she'd been locked in her room for 3 days. G would never react so harshly. Jane loved books, and that had never scared him like it did other men. Yes, it had irritated him in the beginning, a perfectly reasonable reaction, but that was because her books were bulky and space-consuming and seemed to be more important to her than he was, or people in general. Then Jane had read to him underneath the tree in that soft, lilting voice of hers, so sure in the pronunciations of all the big words, like sesquipedalian, which Jane said meant big word. He had never blamed her for reading, or for thinking, or for stating her opinion so often, and God's teeth, she stated her opinion often. He would never have lauded his Lord and Master title over her. But now she was his queen, his sovereign, his ruler. The night of the coronation he had pledged his allegiance to her and her alone. How was he supposed to be a husband after that? Was he to be lord and master of his household as long as his household, the Queen, agreed? The sun continued its speedy trajectory toward the horizon, and G turned back toward London and hastened his trot. His thoughts didn't sound like his own. They sounded more like his father's or his brother's. G had never fully formed his own opinions regarding the roles of men and women in the world. His partnership with Jane had always naturally felt like that. A partnership, not a dominion, not a master-servant situation. Even when they didn't particularly like each other, they treated each other with disdain equally. She tried to throw herself into a pack attack, and he prevented it. He tried to drink himself into an ale-induced stupor, and she hid the stuff. She educated him about herbs and that other plants that grew in that one place she was reading about. He educated her to accept that not all Ethians were good. She knew about tinctures. He knew about alfalfa. She had the soft skin and the delicate cheekbones and that strange way her lips moved along with the words when she read a particularly intriguing passage. G closed his eyes. Her soft skin. Her lips. Those lips that love's own hand did make, he composed wistfully. As he approached the Tower stables, he wondered who would be there to greet him tonight, Her Majesty the Queen of England, or his lady. He walked into the dining room, prepared to find a lavish supper full of servants and silverware and food befitting a queen, but what he saw utterly surprised him. 2 place settings, 2 candles, and a platter holding a small roasted duck surrounded by root vegetables and garnishes, as well as a small bowl of fruit, and the Queen of England sitting at the end of the table. He looked wary. "Your Majesty?" she said.
"My Lord,"
she said, nodding her head. "Where is everybody?"
"Who?"
"Your court? Your ladies, your servants?" She shrugged.
"Being queen comes with several advantages, one of which is that if I order everyone out of the dining room, they obey."
"Even my father?" G said. Jane winced at the mention of his father, but she recovered quickly and replaced the wince with a blank expression.
"Even him. You should have seen the look on his face, but yes, even him."
G's father was obviously a tense subject between them, but right now everything seemed to be a tense subject between them. G grabbed a flask of wine from the end of the room and 2 goblets, even though he was pretty sure only one would be used. He sat himself down at his place on her right-hand side. He filled his goblet, raised the flask toward her in a questioning gesture. She declined, of course. And then he set the flask on his right, out of reach of the Queen. She did not object. If anything, tonight he would prove he could handle his own goblet. He would be king of his cup. They served themselves from the dishes before them, and then G steered their conversation to safe topics. They discussed her day of navigating her queenly duties, and his day of navigating the northeastern hills, her day of picking out the colour of her lady's brocades, and his day of picking hay out of his teeth with his tongue. She said his father was at her side all day long, and she was quite annoyed with his ever-presence, and she would be glad he was to be gone from the castle the following day. "My father is going somewhere," G said. Great. They were back on the subject of his father.
"Yes. I thought you knew. Oh, no, of course you wouldn't, because he received the message while you were in your four-legged state. He was called away urgently to the countryside. He wouldn't say why, so I assumed it was a personal matter."
She brought a hand to her lips.
"Oh, I'm sorry. I should have been concerned that the matter might be of import to you as well, since you are Dudley's son."
She said it as if blood ties to the man directly spoke to his own character. G fought the urge to engage in the territory they'd already covered and raised a hand. "My lady, I am sure everything is fine with my father." And the truth was, G wasn't worried about any sort of family emergency. He could only think that the urgent business calling his father away had more to do with the same business that had occupied the entirety of his father's mind for the past several years, the business of controlling the throne. G guessed this latest message had to do with the hunt for Mary, and if his father was personally answering the call, it meant things were not going well.
"Gifford, are you all right?"
Jane asked. "To be sure," G answered, shaking away the thought. Several times he'd considered telling Jane about what he'd overheard the night of her coronation, but he thought better about it. She had been so distressed about becoming queen in the first place, and if she were to know Mary didn't accept her as sovereign... No, he would hold back the rampant speculation and wait until his father returned with actual news, although if she found out he'd withheld information, she would have a real reason to not trust him. "I am merely concerned with our... I mean, your... first decree as sovereign ruler."
"Oh, right. I've been contemplating that today while I was reading in the book Drafting Decrees, the Ancient Language of Binding Arbitration."
She reached under the table and pulled up a messy stack of parchments, many covered with her handwriting, phrases scrawled, words crossed out.
"I've been practicing how I could phrase it so that I don't mention Ethians directly, or Verities for that matter, but so that it covers them and also covers other people who might be unfairly..."
Her voice trailed off as she looked at G. She had used the word I, not we. He'd wanted the Jane and Gifford we, not the royal we, which she still refused to use. This was definitely the Queen of England, and not his lady, sitting at the head of the table. G leaned back and poured himself another cup of wine.
"Am I boring you?" Jane said.
"No," G responded, "but that's only because I stopped listening ages ago."
"Ah,"
Jane said. She looked down at her plate, her cheeks tinged with pink, and G wondered if he had been too straightforward. But really, did she even need him here for this conversation? She obviously didn't need him by her side ruling the kingdom. Why did she want him around for the drafting of decrees? They ate the rest of their dinner in silence, being that there appeared to be no safe topics left to discuss, and then they went to their separate adjoining residences. The door between them never opened. They didn't see much of each other for the next few days. G's daylight hours were spent wandering farther and farther from the castle, to the point where on the eighth night of the reign of Queen Jane he had gone so far from the castle that when the sun set he was still miles away. He made it to a cluster of trees outside one of the villages surrounding London just as the transformation took place, and he hid himself in a patch of bushes. Why hadn't he figured out how to control this blasted curse yet? He guessed because he hadn't really tried. What he wouldn't give to be at Dudley Castle right now, with its remote location and the roads he knew in the dark of night. Yes, he'd run into this problem a few times when he'd gotten carried away at his home, and he'd discovered that the best course of action was to find a tavern attached to a brothel. There it was easy to grab clothes strewn about, the owners of which would be too sloshed to care. And these kinds of taverns were easy to find. Just follow the noise. G wrangled up a few of the leafier vines, positioned them in all the right places, and ventured out of the trees and into the village, keeping to the shadows and following the noise to the nearest tavern, which was called the Three Ladies. Judging by the ladies standing outside, G had found his place. There are two rules to finding clothes when you need them and are currently without. The first, act like you know what you're doing. The second, do it all in one continuous motion. G took note of the nearest darkened window, inhaled deeply, and dropped the back cluster of leaves. He would need an empty hand. He threw open the window and climbed in, incurring feminine gasps and another figure drunkenly clamouring for light. But it was too late because G was already out the bedroom door wearing someone else's trousers and pulling his arms through shirt sleeves. To the inhabitants of said room, G would be dismissed as a ghost until the following morning when the owner of said trousers discovered their absence. G walked to the adjoining tavern, holding his trousers up to account for the ale belly of the previous owner. He made the decision then and there to cut back on his ale consumption. The coronation of the Queen was so recent that G was fairly certain people wouldn't be able to recognize Her Majesty Queen Jane, let alone her consort. Nevertheless, G kept his head down as he crept from the back rooms and towards the bar. He was so focused on reaching the front door without assault, he almost missed the faint whisper, "Long live Queen Mary!" G stopped and whipped about. Two red uniforms caught his eye. The soldiers were standing at the bar, the bartender handing them brown bags full of something bulky. Perhaps G had misheard the declaration, but no, the names Mary and Jane sounded nothing alike. Then he heard another declaration, whispered again, this time from one of the soldiers at the bar, and in a response, "Long live the true and rightful Queen!" G froze in step. His heart tried to escape up his throat. He swallowed it back down. He knew that he must keep a low profile, although that was more of an automatic response before it was based in logical reasoning. Reason would tell him he was the Queen's consort, after all. The soldiers should be under his wife's control. And yet, here were the rumblings of treason in this random tavern just outside of London. Several more soldiers dotted the seats in the great room of the place, but they had no ale in front of them, only food and water. G had a moment to be grateful he wasn't dressed in his usual finery, and therefore did not look out of place. He strode to the front door, an urgency in his step that wasn't there before, and as he exited the tavern he noticed points of light dotting the hillside. Campfires, tents, an encampment within marching distance of London. He needed to get back to the tower, and fast. Curse his damn curse! Why couldn't he just change at will? He was a horse minutes ago! Minutes ago! He got down on all fours right there in the dirt road and squeezed his eyes shut and...
"Stand up, you daft beggar!"
one of the wobbly tavern patrons said. G waved him off and tried to focus on the feeling of the wind in his mane, his haunches springing from the...
Had too much to drink, that one, another man slurred. Thinks he's an arse.
Realizing it wasn't going to work, G shot up from the ground. A horse, G said sharply to anyone who would listen. A horse! My wife's kingdom for a horse! A group of drunken men looked at Gifford as if they were disgusted someone could consume so much ale.
Peace, ye fat guts,
the largest and sweatiest of the men spat at G.
No one's got your horse.
No, I need a horse. The large man belly laughed.
Of course you do. Hey, Mason, get the beggar man a horse.
The whole group belly laughed, and G thought better of telling them it really wasn't that funny, and that the man who had spoken really had the fat guts, and instead he just took off running toward the castle. G ran flat out for a good minute and a half, before he realized he would have to pace himself, and as a man he didn't have the endurance he enjoyed as a horse. It was going to be a long trip back to the castle. Hours later, when he reached the gates and spent extra time convincing the guards he really was the prince consort, he staggered into the main hall and through the series of stairways that would lead him to the queen's chamber. It was well after the queen would have given up on him for supper and turned in. He used his fist to bang on her chamber door. "Jane!" he shouted. "Jane, open up!" After a few long moments, she opened the door, the vestiges of sleep still in her gaze, a long robe draped over her shoulders. At the sight of G, she pulled the robe even tighter.
"What is it?" she said primly.
He pushed his way inside and shut the door behind them.
"This is very..."
Jane started to say, but G cut her off. "My lady, your majesty, Jane, you need to call a meeting of the council privy."
"It's the Privy Council, Gifford."
"Yes, that. Call a meeting!" He sat on her bed and told her a brief version of events, continuing even after her raised eyebrows at the part where he was in the bedroom of a brothel, all the way to seeing the troops. When he was finished, Jane took hold of one of the posts of her four-poster bed.
But your father assured us we were fine."
"Where is my father?" G asked. "Have you seen him today? Is he back?"
"No, I haven't seen him since he left a few days ago."
G took a deep breath. "Look, I haven't been as forthright with you as I should, but please believe me. I thought I was acting in your best interests, and I will explain it all, but we need to call a meeting of the Privy Council now." She nodded, and G went to the door and shouted for the servant outside to gather the council members, and then he went back in and explained everything to his lady, the message his father had received about Mary, the fact that Mary would never accept Jane as queen, the emergency missive he'd received that had called him away. After he was finished, Jane's face had drained of colour, if that were possible for such a pale creature.
"But surely we would have heard of soldiers encamped so close, especially if they were hostile to the crown."
G nodded. "That's why I wanted to call the meeting of the Privy Council. They all ratified the king's change to the line of succession, but I feel that they have been keeping things from you, and me as well, because they didn't think we could handle it yet." Jane's face grew even paler, so at this point her skin was a grey colour. G took her hand. It was the first time they'd touched in days. "It will be all right. I'm sure the council knows of the advance and has made preparations." Jane went to get dressed while they waited for the council to be gathered. G offered to leave and have one of her ladies come in and help her, but Jane begged him to stay, chair turned, of course, and insisted she could dress herself, because she'd been dressing herself for all these years, and she certainly hadn't forgotten. G begged her not to explain. She finished getting dressed. G went through their adjoining door, quickly put on trousers that fit and a simple tunic, and then returned to Jane, and they waited. and waited, and waited. Hours passed. There was no hint of dawn in the sky, but it couldn't be far off. Jane had taken to pacing her room, and G had the fleeting thought that they would have to reinforce her floor for all the pacing she had done in, what was it, almost 9 days of being queen. Finally, there was a knock on the door. G opened it, and there was the original messenger they'd sent.
"Your lordship, I sent word to the members of the Privy Council, and, well, most of them have quarters nearby, and some don't, so some had to be tracked down, and, well..."
"Well, what?" G said. "Are they all gathered yet?"
"No, my lord."
"That's all right. We will meet with the ones who are gathered so far." It was getting late, after all, and he wanted to meet before the hour of horse.
"But, sir, there are..."
"None."
"None? I do apologise, sir. There are none. I don't know where they are. I've asked the Queen's Guard to look, but I don't know how hard they tried."
Suddenly the messenger just stopped talking and ran away.
"Gee," Jane said. "What is it?"
"Stay here. I'm going to check on something."
G stepped out into the passageway, and Jane followed close behind. He'd known she wouldn't stay. The hallways were strangely quiet, even for the pre-dawn hour. At the very top of the White Tower, they stopped at a window that overlooked the direction of the encampment. G peeked his head out and saw the soldiers and the banners with an embroidered pomegranate on a bed of roses. And then his mouth turned down, and his shoulders sagged, and his heart sank.
"What do you see?"
Jane asked in a hushed whisper.
"An army at the gates."
G tried not to look as terrified as he felt.
"Mary's army."
16. Edward.
"Are we there yet?"
Edward asked for the umpteenth time.
"We're 5 minutes closer than the last time you asked," answered Gracie.
"Well, when are we going to get there?"
"Another day," she answered. "Perhaps 2, if you keep stopping to ask me silly questions."
Edward sighed. After day upon day upon day of trudging north through the woods in the seemingly endless rain, always wet and chilled to the bone, the king was tired of walking. His feet hurt, his head ached, his injured ankle bothered him, and fits of coughing and dizziness regularly overtook him. The poison was still killing him, he supposed. Right now, the poison was the least of his worries. A few days ago, there had been soldiers on the road. The sight of them had filled Edward with dread, because the banners the soldiers marched under were not of the red roaring lion that marked Edward's reign, but a pomegranate on a bed of roses, Mary's insignia. They'd been marching toward London, which meant things were about to get really bad for Jane.
"Can't we find a way to get there any faster?"
he asked, also for the umpteenth time. Gracie smiled over at him with false sweetness.
"You know, this journey would be far quicker if you'd turn yourself into a bird and ride upon my shoulder. Quicker and quieter."
They'd had this argument before.
"No."
Edward didn't think it proper to be carried by a woman. How would she ever be able to see him as a man if she was the one bearing him to safety?
"If we could just travel on the main road," he suggested.
This was also something they'd argued about. "No," she refused flatly.
"The last thing we need is to come upon more soldiers, or even worse, members of the pack. We have to stay out of sight."
"Then perhaps we could acquire a horse?"
She stopped walking and turned to look at him.
"Acquire a horse, you say? Do you know of any nice, friendly farms just giving away their horses?"
He quirked an eyebrow at her. "You're a thief, aren't you?" At least that was what she claimed as her occupation. Stealer of chickens, professional bandit, highwayman when the need arose, cat burglar, occasional pickpocket. She admitted easily to her loose association with the law. Edward wondered how one came by that particular skill set at the tender age of 17, which is how old she told him she was, but Gracie didn't answer a lot of questions when it came to her past. She was somewhat evasive about her present situation as well. "Stealing a horse is punishable by death," she reminded him.
"Unless you happen to know a king who could pardon you."
She set her hand against her hip, and he instantly regretted bringing up who he was. Ever since he'd confessed to being king, the girl had been moody. Oh, she seemed to like him well enough most of the time. She was kind and often merry of soul, and sometimes even wonderfully, confusingly flirtatious. But every now and then she'd remember that he was not just her travel companion, but the King of England, and then she'd go quiet, or even worse, she'd get annoyed with him. Like now, for instance.
"Well, sire..."
She loved to call him sire, but the way she said it made him suspect she was making fun of him.
"You might not have noticed, but you're not exactly a king around here. We can't snap our fingers and have a coach with golden wheels and four fine white horses to carry us wherever we wish to go. We have to make do with our own 2 feet."
Edward tried to think of a clever reply, but then he had to stop to lean against a tree because he was out of breath. Gracie saw the haggard look on his face and turned to squint toward the west, where the sun was quickly descending.
"We should stop for the night."
She slung her pack against a nearby stump and started to set up a quick makeshift camp.
"I could keep going,"
he wheezed as she bustled around gathering kindling.
"I'm perfectly capable of continuing."
She ignored him.
"All right, then,"
he conceded graciously after she got a fire started.
"We can stop if you feel you can't go on."
Even as he spoke, his traitorous body sank to the ground beside the fire, craving its heat. He closed his eyes, just to rest them for a moment.
"Are you going to be all right?"
Gracie asked. He opened his eyes and cleared his throat.
"Of course. I'm perfectly fine. I only agreed to stop because I know women need to rest more often on account of your delicate constitutions."
She snorted.
"All right, then. Wait here. My delicate constitution and I will be back soon."
She bent to remove her boots. Edward tried not to ogle her shapely feminine ankles, a sight that would have been indecent in the royal court, as a woman's ankles were considered scandalously provocative at this time, but he couldn't help staring. She had lovely ankles, he thought. Very nice. Gracie glanced up like she'd felt his gaze.
"Would you like to paint my portrait, sire? It will last longer."
He flushed and looked away, which was a good thing, because then she turned her back to him and quickly removed the rest of her clothes, and was therefore completely naked for all of 3 seconds, which he just caught a glimpse of in his peripheral vision before a light flashed, and where Gracie had been standing, there was a small red fox, complete with pointed ears, whiskers, and a bushy white-tipped tail. Yes. Gracie was a fox. No, really. She was, literally. We know. It's too good. The fox slipped away into the underbrush, silent as a shadow. Darkness fell. He watched the stars come out. The rain had finally stopped, and a gentle breeze was blowing, cooling his face. An owl hooted from somewhere in the trees. It was a beautiful night, the kind of night that makes you pensive. And Edward was alone. It should be mentioned that Edward wasn't accustomed to being alone. In his life before, it had been exceedingly rare for him to have even 15 minutes to himself. He'd been the glorious sun, with an orbit of men revolving constantly about him, men to watch that when he ate he did not choke, men to help him onto his horse, men to teach him Latin, men to comb his hair, men to refill his glass when it was empty, which it never was, because he had men to fill it. Even while he slept, there'd been men standing just outside his door to guard him. And now, here he was, completely alone. He found this situation both euphoric. He could scratch himself, and no one was looking, no one was judging him, no one. And unsettling. What if he choked? Edward could have used